Jonas. So in the practice yesterday, where we paused right in that preliminary to venturing into the main practice, exactly as taught by Padmasambhava in Natural Liberation, where we're just resting the awareness, as he says, resting it evenly in space, without attending to any object, without meditating on anything. So simple. And it's right on this trajectory of not doing, anything that's going to obscure the very nature of awareness, right? So it's because so much of what we do does exactly that. And so I encountered this statement, just it was something highlighted in something I read recently. I think it was from Dujon Rinpoche. So I was listening to a commentary to a very, very short text by Dujon Rinpoche on the threefold space. And the point was made, it's very simple, it's transparent, it's also very deep. And that is when we're just resting in space without even objectifying space, right? And of course, I'm going to say it again, maintaining that clarity, that cognizance, that real clear presence, but without latching on to any object, then there's an awful lot we're not doing that we habitually do that habitually obscures the nature of our substrate consciousness, let alone obscures the nature of Rigpa. And that is when we're resting in that way, then we're not attending to any object. And when we do attend to objects, especially anything that's the least bit attractive or least bit of unattractive or unappealing, then that naturally arouses either craving or aversion, hostility. And as soon as we lock into either of those, we know there's something going on, just by definition. And that is when the mental affliction of, let's say, craving attachment arises for some object. In the Buddhist understanding, in Madhyamaka understanding, there is necessarily reification of that object. If there's no reification, there'll be no attachment and clinging. It's an interesting statement, and it's one that really can be tested. But you understand it, yeah? Because it's said here that, of course, ignorance and delusion lie at the root of all other mental afflictions, the primary of the primary, and the two, how do we say, first or primary derivatives from them, of course, it's craving and hostility. But if either of these mental afflictions of, first of all, craving, if that arises, we first inadvertently, unconsciously reify whatever we're latching onto, thinking that's going to do it for me, that's going to bring me pleasure, but there's something there we can point the finger to, that's it, and that's the reification. And now that and it could be totally intangible. If I were more famous, I could be more handsome, if I could have, anything, greater secure, anything. Tangible, intangible, person, impersonal, material, immaterial. But we lock onto it, reify it as an object, and then the attachment, the tentacles, the squid of attachment comes out and locks on. I want it. If I don't have it, I want it. If I've got it, I want to keep it. And then, of course, then I can be much briefer for the mental affliction of aversion, hostility, anger, hatred, and so forth. It's the same thing. And it's just the opposite. But the squid tentacles here are, I don't like it. It's either getting in the way of something I do want, or it's giving me something I don't want. So when you think about any time you've ever experienced anger, hatred, aversion, and so forth, see if it doesn't fall into those categories. Either I want something, and this doggone thing is obstructing it, or I didn't want this, and this one's giving it to me. And I don't like it. And the finger goes out, right? Well, there it is. That's how we perpetuate. That's how we just keep the wheel of samsara spinning, right? But both of those entail, first of all, locking onto an object, mental, sensory, whatever. You lock on the object, reify it, and then, again, it's a positive, negative. Here comes the shadow. Here comes the attachment. Here comes the hostility. But when we're just resting the awareness in space with no object, and yet remaining cognizant means we're resting right in the nature of awareness versus unawareness, avidya. Then in that process, then one might think, you mean you're treading water? I mean, that would immediately spring to my mind. Okay, well, you're not doing anything virtuous, because, I mean, you're just resting in space. I mean, what's virtuous about that, right? So you're treading water because you're not moving forward in samsara. That is, you're not perpetuating in samsara, but you're just resting there cognitively in space. And so isn't that kind of like, okay, it's little bit like Daniel Dennett's comment about meditation, something he didn't know anything about but didn't stop talking. And that was that, well, at least you're not harming anybody. But that's all that can be said. You're not doing anything meaningful. You're just not harming anybody. So, okay, well, it's better than being a terrorist, I guess. You know? But wouldn't that be, might we not want to side with Daniel Dennett's position here? And I'm just giving one name. There are a lot of people that think that, you know? Religious and non-religious. And so I don't mean to pick on him. He's a very smart guy, that's for sure. But might he have a point here? You're just resting in space, so you're not doing anything. You're not hurting yourself or anybody else. I mean, you're not perpetuating your own samsara. You're not harming anybody else. You're just kind of sitting there doing nothing, not cultivating virtue, not helping anybody. And so then why are you teaching that? And that's because? Because the mind has an extraordinary capacity to heal itself. Your Buddha nature is there. And when we lock onto developmental model, the developmental model on steroids is you're not doing anything at all meaningful unless you're doing something in the world with your body. Say something, do something. You know, don't just sit there stupid, do something. So that kind of negates all of meditation because you're not behaving in some way that's physically measurable. So a lot of people go along with that. Meditation just in general is a waste of time because you're just sitting there, right? But this is subtler than that. And that is this, so that's a developmental model. Also, I know a number of Buddhists that think, well, if you're just sitting there like you're just watching your breath, that's not virtuous. And so you're kind of wasting your time. You should be doing something, at least practice Donglen or do some discursive meditation, recite a mantra, do a visualization, but don't just sit there stupid, you know. And there's an approach that's kind of is equating spiritual practice with a developmental model. If you're not doing something to develop your mind, then you're just sitting there like a, you know, like a rock in mud, just nothing. But it's missing out something. It's missing out something that is awfully important. And that is this discovery model. It's so important. I mean, it's kind of like, it is something of a revolution within Dharma, and it came as a revolution for me. Because most of my training, and I don't put any fault on any of my teachers, they were teaching me, what I needed to learn for the first 20 years. But I didn't hear much about the discovery model business. I was hearing pretty much developmental model, right? And they taught it superbly, and it's very, very beneficial. But the notion that when you release, when you relax, and without shrouding your mind, now obscuring your mind with dullness and laxity, one of the five obscurations, without doing that, then in fact something quite marvelous may happen, and you're not doing it. So whenever you hear the word grace or blessing, that's suggesting something wonderful is happening and you're not doing it, right? If you're doing it, it's not grace. If you're doing it, it's not a blessing. Blessing is something given, something that happens. So if you're a theist, you might think, thank you, God, or the angels, or Jesus, or you might thank your guru, the Buddha, or Bodhisattvas, and so forth. You want to find, there must be somebody out there that did it. Thank you, whoever you are. I know, probably you. But the discovery model here, is that that's fine, that's good to feel gratitude, to express gratitude. What you're expressing gratitude is an objective symbol of your own Buddha nature. Because that's the ultimate source of blessing, of grace. And when you say your own Buddha nature, always remember what I mean by that. That is not your own little private possession, something local, something that belongs to a woman or a man, right? Because it's beyond, it's utterly beyond. It's beyond any conceptual category. And it's beyond, very importantly beyond, the very bifurcation of two conceptual categories. Is it one or many? Is it mine or not mine? And it said one's own simply to ward off the notion of thinking that you're a little fish being swallowed by a big fish. That somehow you're here and this belongs to somebody else. You're gurus or gods or Buddhas or Samadabhadras. That it's somebody else coming from outside. Well, not that. Not that. So don't look outside your own awareness. But then your own awareness isn't individual on this dimension. Coarse mind? Sure. Subtle mind? Yeah. Although it's no longer human at that level. Very subtle mind? Rigpa? Oh. Right? So when we're just doing that initial phase that we did yesterday, just resting in space, even without even taking space as an object, remaining cognizant. We've stopped doing an awful lot that perpetuates the samsara and actively obscures the nature of the substrate consciousness and rikpa. And lo and behold, in so doing that, we make ourselves open to grace. We make ourselves open to blessing. Blessing from what? Well, from our own Buddha nature. It's as if it's like a geyser. Lama Yeshe once, the wonderful, and so sad for many of us, including me, that he lived such a short life. But the companion, the teacher of Lama Zubar Rinpoche, who's still doing wonderful things all over the world. But Lama Yeshe made this very simple and lovely example many years ago. He said, you know, the Buddha nature is like living out like almost like a homeless person, living in a little tent, a little shanty, a little crappy little place, and living in utmost poverty, right? And then, but if you just took a broom and you would just kind of sweep the dirt on the bottom of your little tent, at the floor of your tent, you'd find, oh my goodness, that's a treasure. And it belongs to me. But you had to unveil it, right? You say, oh, but I'm rich. That's it, Buddha nature. But you have to just sweep away the obscurations a little bit, right? Well, that's a lovely, I remembered, obviously, and it was like 30, 40 years ago that I heard that. But I'll say it's even better than that. It's more like perishing for lack of water, right? You're just dehydrated, you're wiped out. In the meantime, you're sitting on a geyser of sparkling artesian water, you know, pure, even sparkling water. I like sparkling water a little bit better than flat, so I'm going to make it sparkling water. A geyser of sparkling water. And you're sitting there, oh, I'm so thirsty. My mouth is throat dry. Oh, man, what can I do? My seat is so uncomfortable, I keep on having to squish it down. If you would just kind of lighten up a little bit, then the geyser would just come and envelop you. And it's your geyser. So when we just really profoundly stop doing, then the geyser, the artesian well of our own Buddha nature, pristine awareness, flows up and embraces us. And many of you have had spikes of that. And so you know what I'm talking about. This is not some dogma, some indoctrination. Am I feeding you a placebo effect? You betcha. Am I being suggestive? Absolutely, yes. Would I be happy if my words triggered you're starting to experience it spontaneously? Absolutely, yes. If that happens, is it coming because of my words? Absurdly not. Right? It's simply opening things up. So there it is for yesterday. Resting, doing nothing, but then allowing this welling up to slowly emerge, to unveil itself, this hidden treasure, this artesian well. And now this morning, without much further ado, we'll take the next step, and you know what's coming. I'm going to front load this so I can be quiet during the session. And that is rest for a while, whether it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, it's your call. But rest where you're experiencing that utter simplicity of doing nothing, of going nowhere, of being mindfully present, without distraction, without grasping. Until when the spirit moves you, you're so vividly aware of something that you weren't deliberately intending to attend to, and that is consciousness, the experience of being aware, that you allow that awareness to become very explicit. Right? So instead of, I'm going to choose my words very carefully here, though. So you're resting with no object, but something looms large. And again, the image that comes to my mind is the sun rising behind your back. And suddenly you just feel suffused with this sense of clarity, or maybe even warmth. When that becomes really obvious, that it's not true, that nothing is happening, that you are aware of being aware, then let that become explicit. Not through withdrawal. I'm going to stop using that word because I think it too often misleads or misdirects. It's not a withdrawal because you're not attending to anything anyway, not deliberately. But when you do have that very explicit sense of being aware of being aware, then acknowledge it. You're not objectifying awareness. You're still not taking an object, because then it would be shamatha with a sign. This is shamatha without a sign, a.k.a. awareness of awareness. So nominally, we say, what's the object of meditation? Awareness. Experientially, there's no object that you're attending to. That's it. You're simply aware of what you are aware of already. And you can't stop being aware of unless you fall asleep. And your substrate consciousness is shrouded, veiled, obscured by the substrate. So remain there. And you're still not taking any object to be reified, let alone to crave or to be averse to. Just resting in that awareness. And then let shamatha be delivered to you on a plate. Like children at the dining table. Remember, I think I probably gave that analogy. I like it. Like children in the dining room for dinner. And mama's gone into the kitchen. And dad too. Dad's helping out today. So mom and dad go into the kitchen. And they're bringing out. And they know, just a minute, kids, we have a big surprise for you. Something really nice coming. Mom and dad made you a really nice meal. And so just sit tight. We're bringing it right out. So what do the kids need to do in order to get a meal? Be good. Just sit there and see what's coming. Okay? Just sit there without waiting, without expectation, because the meal's actually already been served. It's right there in your lap. Maybe that's a bad analogy. It's right there in front of you. But no, it's not. It's not right there in front of you. It's right where you are. That's better. Not in your lap, not in front of you. The meal's already served. You're the meal. That's not turning out too well either, is it? Okay, every analogy has its limitations. I think I've simply bumped into several of mine. This is why, you know, this practice is all discovery, so it's actually hard to find words that don't mislead. That being the case, I think I'm now going to practice what I've been preaching and stop talking and enjoy your session. You know what to do and what not to do. Voilà, so. So time is already running short, so I'll try to be, I don't know how successful, to be fairly concise. Having yesterday looked at the outer necessary conditions for the practice and achievement of shamatha. You can practice it anywhere. How successful you will be, well, that's an open question. And shamatha is quite unlike most other meditations within the Buddhist tradition, which you can practice in a wide variety of circumstances. You can practice donglen, lojong, the four immeasurables, lamrim, while sitting in an airport, you know, waiting for your flight. Why not? So many practices, many, many types of meditation you can do in a wide variety of environments. But shamatha is kind of like, for a while you need an incubator, just for that period. You can practice at any time. You can sit it, you know, when there's a red light, when you're driving, you can for 1 minute practice shamatha, of course, just keep your eyes open. You can do that. But to achieve shamatha, oh, that's a different thing. Then you want that kind of environment that we discussed yesterday, and you want it for a sustained period. So as Tsongkhapa says, it's like trying to make fire by rubbing sticks together. You have to continue rubbing them constantly until you get the spark. You can't do it for 30 seconds and stop and 30 seconds and stop. You'll never, ever get it. And so likewise with shamatha, you really want continuity. The optimal situation is that the outer circumstance is one where you can move into and have that confidence, here I stay until I've achieved shamatha. So it's not easy to find. But there it is. But that's practical. It's measurable. It's out there in the physical world. The inner qualities, obviously much less tangible, and there are five of them. I've memorized them, so I won't open up my notes. And that is, first of all, having few desires. This is where the inner preparation of a shamatha, not just finding the place and saving up your money and doing all the logistical things to move into retreat, but the much more important inner preparation, that when you're going into retreat, you already have very few desires, very few reliances, very few addictions, right? And that is, for example, for entertainment, when you get bored, if right up to the time you're going into retreat, you say, oh, I'm bored, let's turn on the television. Where's my iPod? Where's my iPad? Where's my iPhone? Where's my television? Where's the internet? Where's my friends? And, oh, let's call up somebody. And like, so if that's your way of dealing with boredom, and you're going to take that into retreat where there's no I. In fact, as much as possible, it's quite egoless. That's going to be a rough transition. You're not going to make it because you're going to feel like a heroin addict that's just been put, you know, gone cold turkey. It's going to be really tough, and you're going to be bored. You're going to be either, you remember the cat and the elephant. You'll be either on the surface of the water, thrashing around on the surface like the cat, or you'll be sinking like a stone, like a tired out cat. You'll either be thrashing around in agitation, restless, and so forth, or your mind will start getting really heavy. You'll get bored and then depressed, and you're going to lose all enthusiasm for the practice and say, oh, what am I doing here? I'm wasting my time, right? As opposed to the elephant who's sitting in the same pond and just really enjoying it. So having few desires, simply crucial. And this is where you want to wean yourself off of, like a baby off of breast milk. You want to wean yourself off of all these outer props that are there, you know, all your hedonic props to keep you happy and light and cheerful. Because in solitude, when you're living in total simplicity, you don't have them. Your enjoyments will be watching the sunset, the sunrise, the beauties of nature. And optimally, that would be pretty much it. And types of beauty, types of lovely things that don't tend to arouse so much attachment, right? So there's the first one. And this is a lot of preparation. So you're kind of living more and more as if you're in retreat before you go into retreat, and then when you get there, you say, "Oh, but this is easy. And here's what it is: I don't desire things that I don't have right here. I have enough food, shelter, clothing. It's a quiet, peaceful environment. What more could I want? Good. This is what I wanted, and now I'm just going to practice shamatha, and not wishing for that which you don't have." Mm-hmm. So that's the first one. The second one is just the flip side of the same coin, and that is having contentment. So having few desires is not desiring that which you don't have, you know, more, better, whatever. And contentment is being content with what you do have. Even though it kind of boils down to the same thing, it's worth saying both. But this is not only in terms of your physical environment, the quality of food, your clothing, and so forth and so on, but when you're in practice, and I've emphasized this many times already, when you're in your practice and you're attending to the whole course of the in-breath and the whole course of the out-breath, that awareness that you're doing the practice correctly and the contentment that you're doing it correctly, being totally satisfied that you're doing the practice correctly, and that's it. This is called achieving shamatha. And that's all. You don't have to wait one day to achieve shamatha. This is called achieving shamatha and being content. So being content with your environment, if you have companions, a little cluster of fellow yogis, being content with them. But most importantly, most nuclear, is right in your practice. Being content. And when you're out on walks and just going and letting your awareness be spacious, out in the space around you, the visual, the auditory, the sensation of your body in contact with the earth, being content just to be walking and to be present, mindfully walking, and being content with that. If you have desires or you're not content while doing the practice, you're not going to go very far. Okay? So there's no fluff here. There's no extra ones. Each one of these is utterly essential. So that's 2 out of 5. The third one is having few activities and concerns. So in between sessions, you don't want to be cluttering your mind, for example, getting on the internet or doing work that really activates your mind, or writing letters, getting on the phone with mom or girlfriend, etc., etc. So having really few desires. Your life is now stripped down to the naked essentials, really simple, right? And so you're not cluttering it with types of activities that's going to spawn or catalyze rumination, distraction, or just other ideas. Oh, I could be doing this. I've heard there's a 3-year retreat going on. I've heard there's a great Lama coming into town, and he's giving an empowerment that's really rare and really precious. How many times have you heard that, old-timers? You know? And it's true, but this is a time when, you know, it'd be good not to be distracted. And so having few activities and few concerns, mundane concerns, any types of concerns, few activities, that you just have nothing to do besides practice Dharma. That's the third one. The fourth one is keeping very pure ethics, body, speech, and mind. Okay? So really strong emphasis on nonviolence in any way. But there it is. Not engaging in any type of activity of body, speech, or mind that throws your mind into a state of imbalance, that erodes your practice, that takes away from your enthusiasm for practice, or in any way interferes with anybody else's practice, if you're with a cluster of yogis, or harms any other sentient being in your environment. This is why when you come in, then it's very common in traditional Tibetan Buddhist practice, coming into a retreat place, you arrive there, and then you just offer prayers, any spirits, any type of entities, any animals, any creatures, any devas, any nagas, anything. Hello, neighbors. Hello, I'm coming into your territory. I come in peace. I'm just wishing to practice Dharma for the sake of all sentient beings. I offer you well. Maybe we'd like some offerings here. And please kind of let me know, let me alone, or just bless me. And so there you are, in peace with your environment. So ethics, absolutely crucial. Without that, you may as well not go into retreat. Not going to happen. Okay. And then the final one, it just rolls off my tongue. I think I know it better than my address. I do, actually. I know it better than my address. And that is, Dvala Sobe Namdo Yongsu Pamba. Dvala Sobe Yongsu Pamba. Namdo. Ola, so it is completely, Pangba means completely rejecting, getting rid of, abandoning, whew, releasing all rumination, namdo, obsessive compulsive ideation, involving craving, etc. So in other words, in our one-on-one meetings, I've often, when speaking about the quality of mindfulness in between sessions, I've often said, try to let your mindfulness throughout the whole course of the day be like filling a bathtub with water. And it's an obvious analogy, and that is when the water rises up, it all rises evenly. You don't have it, you know, in spikes or spurts and so forth. There it is. We've all filled bathtubs. And so there it is evenly. So in a similar way, whether you're meditating 5 hours a day or 15 hours a day, that is throughout the course of the day, try to just elevate the whole quality of still, clear mindfulness. Not to say that you never think, but if any thought arises, for example, in between sessions, that it's like illuminated by a really bright light. And if you want to think, think. Imagine, remember, remember. Think creatively, no problem. But just let it all be out there in the open. So no thoughts kind of creep up behind you and get you in their clutches, you know, and throw you into a non-lucid rumination. So there it is. So that's kind of a tall order. But if you don't follow that one, if you kind of have a sense, when I'm on my cushion, then I'm really practicing. When I'm off, well, then I'm taking a break. Or the first time I ever translated for Gyatso Rinpoche, oh, there was his host, the Dharma Center someplace. So again, I don't want to point to any person. But so there was, he was giving these marvelous teachings on Shamatha and Vipassana in the book, in Kamachamya's writings. It was brilliant. I was breathtaking. It took my breath away. Got to be translating for these teachings. And it went on for like a weekend. And on the second day, the head of the Dharma Center excused himself. And he said, I'm Dharma'd out. I'm taking a break. After one day, I'm Dharma'd out. I said, wow, I've never heard that phrase before. You're Dharma'd out after one day. Oh, man. California dreamer. Well, there it is, you know. Taking vacation from Dharma. This kind of binge Dharma, you know. Going for, whether it's a Sesshin in the Zen tradition, or going for a 1 month, a 3 month Vajrasattva. Man, I was really practicing. It was so good to get out of there, because after I had a really good time, we went off and, man, we partied, you know. Or, you know, it happens in the Nyingma tradition, the beloved Nyingma tradition. Oh, then I'm really getting a lot of party. Real serious meditation, then party time. Dharma'd out, okay? That's okay. If you want to Dharma out, you can Dharma out. It's free country. But if you're practicing shamatha and you want to achieve shamatha, then don't Dharma out, right? Mindfulness, like raising the water in a bathtub. Even. Relentless. Gently relentless. To be all in for sanity all day. No slipping back into non-lucidity. And then when you maintain that, to the extent that you maintain that, then even when you're falling asleep, you're going to find it easier to fall asleep lucidly. You're going to find it easier to maintain to arouse lucidity in the dream. I was almost about to mention somebody yesterday who actually entered it was in the dreamless sleep lucidly and then entered into a dream lucidly. This is like a tulku. You know, ordinary sentient beings like me, we're just thrown around by karma, propelled here, propelled there. What's up? What's up? Oh, I'm dead. You know, whereas a tulku, if it's an authentic tulku, then a tulku enters into life not thrown by karma, but by motivated by compassion, guided by wisdom, and comes in lucidly. Right? So you actually know what's going on when you arrive. That's a tulku, an emanated body. So that's a person who enters into this world lucidly, as it's possible and a bit more accessible for us to enter into a dream lucidly. So that's it. Enjoy your day. I'll see somebody in about 3 minutes.